this is what youth? What youth? We'll just disconnect. Leon has been very appropriate. He showed up every show. He shows up on time, ahead of time. So thanks for doing that, Leon. You're muted. You can speak. That was awesome music on Payday, I think you said.
Yeah, it was incredible. I didn't need to listen to like the first 20 minutes of it, but otherwise, like, the majority that I heard was amazing. Great
mashup.
Did
you say you missed?
Did you
miss the first 20 minutes or you didn't?
I missed the first 20 minutes. Yeah, I had the rest of it.
Okay, so where's Jermaine and Kate? What's with them? Their show, man. They're not here.
I don't know.
Right. Now, it says Anonymous is blocked. I wonder what that is. What's Anonymous? Is that somebody we know? You want to speak Anonymous? Nope, they're not saying anything. I don't know if that's Bill or us. I don't know. So we'll keep it open in case you want to say something. Okay, well, I got some interesting things to read today. Do you have anything you want to talk about, Leon? Remember, we're trying to start a revolution. You got any ideas on how to do that?
Not quite yet. Not yet. But go ahead, because I actually love your reading on Payday last Saturday. It was amazing. The Marsh McLuhan, I believe it was the 1977.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was like a left and right hemisphere and like TV and autism, and that was incredible.
Right. Now, you're talking about something I read, not a phone recording.
No, it wasn't a phone recording, something that you read last Saturday.
Yeah.
Live.
Yeah, it was pretty clear. Okay, let's start. I've got one of the last things he seems to have written before he had a stroke, and then he couldn't talk for a year, then he died in the last day of 1980. So this is about the future of about 10 topics. So we'll start off with the big picture, the future of the planet as an art form. He writes, the creation of space capsules consists in extending the planetary environment. Armed with radio, telescopes, and satellites, the Earth has become a probe in space. This probing has created a lot of new space and needed a new environment for the Earth. Now, that's what Ion said about in the first recordings we made. I think they're called on How Ionic, I don't know what they're called, Basics or something. He said Elvis Presley created new space, added to the universe. So the Earth dropped being nature as described in a frame by visual space and became a probe. So McLuhan says this probing, armed with radio, telescope, and satellites, has created a lot of new space and needed a new environment for the Earth. So people didn't realize when the Russians put up Sputnik on October 4th, 1957, that a new environment for the Earth was required because the Earth was obsolesced by the satellite environment, beginning with Sputnik. So then he says, the Earth now ceases to be a mere environment for its occupants. We don't live in Earth on Earth anymore. And it is becoming the content of a man-made environment or a human-made environment. The content of any environment is always processed into an art form. Our planet will become an art form in the sense that all its energies will be shaped and patterned in new ways. As the content of a new space that's created by electronic machines, the Earth is already becoming exceedingly present to our awareness. As the content of a new space, the Earth is already becoming exceedingly present to our awareness. That was the birth of ecology. So ecology was a rearview mirror action, becoming aware of the old environment. But the new environment is like the environment that Ion talks about, doesn't require concepts of negativity or of negative poisons. So the Earth is already, now what's that? Okay, you're anonymous. You're making noises. That means you're there. You want to say something? Who are you? Why don't you speak? Okay, so we'll mute that person. As the content of a new space, the Earth is already becoming exceedingly present to our awareness. Its climate is not something we need take for granted anymore. So the idea of programming the climate is turning the old earth into an art form. So that was the first big picture. And then he said that was the future of the planet as an art form. Okay, so let's go to the future of education. The future of education. The teachers, do you have anything to say about that, the planet as art form?
Not exactly, but I was wondering, like, whether, when it has these unique changes, is that almost kind of like an art form?
No, the old environment, the earth that people called nature, that is not the new environment. That's the old environment, and we become aware of it when a new environment made up of satellites and electronic communication systems goes around what we call nature. So the old environment becomes an art form. It's not
okay,
necessarily
so
the... It doesn't mean it's important. The art form is something we can sort of notice, so then we say, let's make it better. Let's improve on it. Let's try to cover up the accidents that happened before. But that's what we do. We work on the past. We don't work in the present. The present is too hard to perceive. And there may be no improvements necessary, but we have the desire to improve the past once it's visible. And we miss the present.
Now, is that more in a sense when they say nature? Is it more like how we act and operate like human beings,
no,
or is it...
That's human nature. No, this is nature. The idea we have bodies and the world you see with your eyes and ears, that's nature.
Okay.
And that includes psychological attributes. Well, look, there's another anonymous. Maybe these are Katie or they come in differently. So Kate and Jermaine, are you there through the anonymous link? Want to speak? So that's Kate? Who said yes? Can't you hear us? Did you say yes?
Hello?
Yes, you did say yes. What's your name?
Oh, sorry.
What? Then they hang up. Who are these people? So I guess it wasn't Kate. Got one more anonymous. Do you want to speak? Okay. So the word art form doesn't mean it's glorious. It means it's noticeable, and you want to improve on it. You get fooled into thinking, well, I can make this form better. And you do that as a form of distraction and ignore the raw present, which is not categorizable. You can't put value judgments on the present. But you're agitated by the present because you don't notice it. You can't see what it's doing. And you don't know why it's making you aware of the past, which we turn into an art form.
So, oh, okay.
It doesn't mean it's wonderful that it's becoming an art form. It's a knee-jerk, unconscious reaction, as I was explaining, I don't know, Monday or on payday. That is McLuhan's real discovery, this turning the past into a consciousness because you're unconscious of the present. We'll call that McLuhan's technological unconscious, as opposed to Freud's unconscious or Carl Jung's unconscious or Foucault's unconscious. McLuhan had a more interesting, more practical today notion of the unconscious. So when he writes about education, the future of education, McLuhan says, the teacher's job is to save the student's time. With electric circuitry, that's another word for the electric environment, satellites, telephone, radio, the electric circuitry. With electric circuitry, the trend in education is from instruction to discovery. Discovery is participation in the creative or learning process. It is not concerned with classified data, but with insight into the operational causes of things. So this show is sympathetic to people, to students, so-called young people, in difference to the subjects they get in school. They are correct. These classified, divided subjects are irrelevant in an electrified world. But we still want to have insight into the operational causes of things. So the cause of something become an art form is one of the applications of McLuhan's formula of his technological unconscious. So education is involved with discovery. Is that happening? Did education move from instruction to discovery? Not necessarily. As our information movement speeds up electrically, we become overburdened with data on one hand, but also liberated by insight on the other hand. And insights are ideas and patterns that people get from pop culture, from movies, from usually information outside of the classroom. It's a classroom that creates an overburdening with data because it starts demanding you to learn different topics, different subjects. So insight comes by pattern recognitions. Patterns become manifest as the environment becomes electrically responsive. Now look at that sense. There's McLuhan describing how technology comes alive, how we eventually get to the Android meme. Patterns become manifest as the environment becomes electrically responsive, starts to respond to you. Indeed, electric circuitry consists in putting our nervous systems outside ourselves. In some degree, therefore, we are putting our learning apparatus outside as the new environment. This is almost a direct extension of consciousness. So this leads to the world of discovery when we realize our environment is the new classroom, a classroom not burdened by classified subjects, but by pattern recognition. So in some degree, therefore, we are putting our learning apparatus outside as the new environment. This is almost a direct extension of consciousness. The workers at the Hawthorne plant, they were studied. As their work became involved in the process of learning and discovery, they expressed themselves in a great release of new motivational energy. So what they did, they started just to observe the workers, and they thought, well, maybe we should turn up the heat, turn up the lights, and that, and adjust the environment. And they thought that's what got the work output increasing. But it turned out it wasn't any particular thing that this researchers were doing to the Hawthorne plant workers' environment. It was the fact that they were being observed, just observed, that made the workers have new motivational energy. So The researcher, think about that. The researcher or the discoverer never flags, never experiences fatigue, since the feedback from the discoveries releases new energies. So there's McLuhan describing exactly why I have energy, why I seem to never flag. He knows. The researcher or the discoverer never flags, never experiences fatigue, since the feedback from the discoveries releases new energies. Right? So if you're free to make discoveries, you've got energy. You won't be after sleep. So then we've quoted this before. Robert Oppenheimer is fond of saying, quote, there are children playing here in the street who could solve some of my toughest problems in physics because they have modes of perception that I lost long ago, unquote. So McLuhan quotes Oppenheimer and says, as the business of man becomes the creating and programming of environments, and that's what happens under satellite conditions, learning and pattern recognition become the joyful means of responding to environments. And these environments are responding to you more and more. In Propaganda, a book by Jacques Ellul, he points out how the small child of the 20th century works harder than any young person of any previous culture. The child of today, living in an information environment, is engaged in continually processing data on a massive scale. He or she is engaged in a major form of work that is inseparable from his growing up. Indeed, growing up has become for young people today their main task in life. Now, Marshall's putting on the category of young people there. He knows there are no young people, actually. Indeed, growing up has become for young people today their main task in life. It has been said that the main work of royalty has been growing up. In the past, the royal personage had as his first duty to his kingdom to exert all of his faculties in the acquisition of knowledge. This royal task of total growth and development has become strangely the unmistakable role of man in society in the electronic age. Read that again. This royal task of total growth and development has become strangely the unmistakable role of everybody in society in the electronic age. We all end up living the life of aristocrats in terms of growing up. Continuing education is now both the work and the privilege of all men. Top management and top professional men and women must regularly return to school in our time. A surgeon or an engineer can become obsolescent in a few years. That's why McLuhan called our time not earning a living, but learning a living. The old concept of education as instruction derives from the written and printed word. Instruction consists in acquiring what had already been thought and said. Today we have learned that new discovery is also the quickest way to obtain access to the riches of the past. Far from there being any conflict between instruction and discovery, they are complementary. So McLuhan wrote that 60 years ago. So half a century, he said that. Do we see any indication of that happening in society in any form? Leon.
As in
the only one
today?
Leon.
Yeah, well, I noticed that.
2015.
I noticed that today, like, a lot of professionals do have to go back to school to learn something new about either their industry or to keep up with what's going on.
Right.
Like, even though, like, they got their either their whatever their previous higher education was, either a BA or a master or a PhD, they still have to go back to school just to, you know, learn some new technique or go to a trade school to find out a new way to interact with the new culture or the new generation that comes about.
Right, and the new technologies. There's always new technology
mm-hmm.
being made. And whenever McLuhan got to speak at graduations, he always opened with apologizing to the students that they've been forced to be in school for 3 or 4 years and they are now obsolete. He did not tell them some highfalutin ideals that Hillary Clinton and those tell people about what a great opportunity to be a young person today, blah, blah, blah. He says, no. Marshall got realistic with him. You're obsolete already, and you're going to have to start hanging out with me, said Marshall McLuhan, if you want to catch up. So education went to discovery and left behind instruction in the Android meme phase when people had access to incredible information once they got their computers and their iPhones and all that stuff. They're engaged and they become research addicts. They're now actually discovering too much and they need patterns that stop the racing of the mind in its panic to keep up. That's what we are offering here. We are offering a revolution in perception so that the kids can then focus on some other kinds of revolutions and not be always behind the billiard ball and in a state of nervous agitation. Okay, so that's the future of education by Mark McLuhan. How about the future of work? So we're doing a sequence here. You're born into the planet, and you find out, if you listen to this show, that the planet ain't what it used to be, and where you thought you were living, and what they taught you were living in, ain't the fact. You're living inside circuitry. So the planet as an art form, and actually the new environment, which includes the old image of the planet, has become a probe. Then you get into the future of education, so they send you to schools, and you have to put up with that nonsense for a long time. And we just discussed McLuhan giving you the hope of understanding where insights come from in the new environment. So then you get out of school, and you go to work. So what's the future of work 60 years ago, and probably still applies to today? McLuhan writes, the organization of work in the form of a job reached significant development only in the 16th and 17th centuries. People didn't have jobs before that. They had hardship. Now, I'm saying that line. So, the job reached significant development only in the 16th and 17th centuries. The printed book, made from movable types, that's the Gutenberg book, was the first technology to fragment in specialized tasks. It was the first form of mass production. The printed book was not only the first uniform and repeatable commodity, but it was sufficiently powerful to create that form of human association which we call the public. Before the book, there were many publics, small p, but no public, capital P, the rise of the homogeneous public. The rise of the public made possible the rise of markets, capitalism. I had capitalism, as well as the rise of democratic politics. The public was made up of individuals, each with a point of view. The public was an organization of human energies by means of specialism that increasingly tended toward the making of jobs. So jobs come in 200 years after the printing press. Before jobs, people had roles. They were involved in the society in depth, having many kinds of functions. The top executive today in the 20th century does not have a job. He has 40 jobs. That is, he has a role. A mother does not have a job. She has 40 jobs at once. That is a role. A closely knit complex of tasks and functions creates a role. Under electric conditions, when all human transactions tend toward a form of service and towards ever closer recognition of the needs of others, the specialist job cannot endure. The mere speed-up of operations and information movement ensures that all existing jobs will merge into roles. So they call it unemployment, but actually people are processing the information environment and aren't paid for it, or unless they're paid for it on welfare or unemployment insurance. But everybody is very involved in the society more and more, and there aren't enough fragmented positions to occupy them. So they start inventing roles. They become a dope dealer on the side. They start a musical group. They pretend to learn and sign up for some class here and there. They watch a lot of TV. That's work. That's role-playing. So the mere speed up of operations and information movement ensures that all existing jobs will merge into roles. And whereas the old job was fragmented and repetitive and uncertain, the new job or the role is in-depth and carries with it complete psychic involvement and security. Just by able to turn on the radio, turn on the media, to find out what's going on, to get informed, is a role player. You're in the participation mystique. So McLuhan writes, after World War II, there was some alarm at the tendency of young men to seek employment in large corporations. The young people's illusion, if any, was that the corporation offered an image and a role rather than a mere job. Necessarily, and this would be in the 50s, the so-called bland 50s, necessarily in a world constituted by information, work is increasingly in the direction of the processing of such information. So having a role is processing the information environment. Since the environment itself is more and more constituted by information, the environment becomes a colossal teaching machine that works upon and for small children and adults alike at all times. See, so there he is pointing out that the category of children and young adults or young people is not applicable when you're all engaging in the task of processing the information society. See, so he says small children and adults are alike at all times. Even today, work has increasingly become sheer learning and knowing. As information accelerates, knowing becomes doing. Now, this is 60 years ago, Leon. He's describing what people naturally experience today. Anybody can. This is actually a description of the old environment by 2010, processing information. But he's describing the future way back there 60 years ago. The world that everybody knows is an art form and obsolete today. People are forced to process information as information becomes increasingly obsolete or engaged in the dialogue of the machines that are pretending to respond to you more and more. Even today, work has increasingly become sheer learning and knowing. As information accelerates, knowing becomes doing. So if you wake up, you know, they say that Japanese kids... I heard this a few years ago. They just stay in their room and refuse to come out of their bedroom and stay in there for a couple of years. Of course, they're on the chip body processing information. They know their main job is just doing, which turns out to be knowing and staying up with whatever they think is important information or pattern recognition. So McLuhan predicted this. As information accelerates, knowing becomes doing. The environment becomes responsive. There it is, the Android meme. Starting to come alive and respond to you, and the doer becomes responsive to the Android meme, McLuhan says, and the doer becomes responsive to the environment. All business enterprises today tend in the direction of the creation, not of products, but of environments. So when you invent something, a new app, you're creating a new environment, which is going to affect the other environments that already happen. So business is not making products, they're creating environments. It was somewhat misleading to call this the image, that they were involved with image. No, they were creating environments. The creation of responsive environments, the app, is really what is meant when we talk about the growth of the service industries. In the age of electric information, all products tend increasingly to get translated into forms of direct personal service. For example, Xerox or xerography means that the book can be tailor-made for the individual reader instead of being a mass-produced package. The Xerox book can take into account the needs as well as the previous experience and learning of the reader. The tendency is for the reader to become both author as well as publisher with Xerox. This is 60 years ago. This change from extremely centralized to extremely decentralized action offers a very good index of the changing patterns of work and learning and of work as learning. So we are defining the environment today, bit of a didactic process here, the terms of what you think are the categories. So far we've done what you're born into, planet as art form, and incredible probe, then education, then the future of work. So what would be next? What's McLuhan got? The future of work. So you found out you don't even have to go to an old job. You are working. Just here, right now, Leon, you're working.
Yeah, processing information and responding.
Right, right. So then, okay, so now you're working. So then you get off work, and you are in an environment that's visible. That would be the city. So what is the future of the city? So Marshall says, Marsh McLuhan, for those that don't know what's going on here, we're quoting Marsh McLuhan, born in 1911, passed on the last day of 1980, 3 weeks after John Lennon was shot, supposedly shot, though we found out later, I think we found out later, he had faked his death. But anyways, Lennon and McLuhan, two icons of the 60s, died, passed on, transitioned in the world of media and imagery a few weeks before Ronald Reagan brought in the virtual society in politics. So the two people who maybe sang about the virtual society or had to live with the early versions of it, they were knocked out when Reagan was coming to power. And McLuhan predicted Reagan would be a great president or a accurate president or an appropriate president 6 years before, in 1975. So McLuhan writes, the future of the city. Metropolitan areas, as we know them, were developed as a result of railway technology. So in the 19th century, railroads made the big cities, Chicago, New York, Detroit, possible. The city with its grid plan, began as a railhead, much as the department store began as a transfer of newspaper advertising to architectural form. The next sentence will explain that. So the department store comes in with the railhead cities. The department store put under one roof what the newspaper put on one page. So all the different items on a newspaper page encouraged making a store where every kind of item was available, and that was called the department store. So the department store was a transfer of the newspaper advertising or the newspaper page to architectural form. If the railway created the modern city, the motor car has unmade the modern city. The individual mobility of the car creates quite different spaces from the railway. The motor car creates the suburb and the shopping plaza. The car decentralizes, whereas the railway centralized. The motor car, moving daily from suburb to city, is considerably dependent upon the filing cabinet in the city offices. So people drive from the city, from the suburb, take the train, or drive into the city to have access to the filing cabinet and the telephone. So McLuhan, he doesn't say that right here, but he used to say it was pretty silly that we had to drive into town to get on the phone when we could have done the phone at home. So the motor car is considerably dependent upon the filing cabinet in the city offices. Xerography, or Xeroxing, could make the contents of the filing cabinet instantly available anywhere. So as well as the telephone, making you everywhere, verbally, visually, Xerox could make you everywhere. Xerox could cause the wheels of the car to cease from turning, so people wouldn't have to drive into the city. Xerox is electric circuitry. Its meaning for the book is obvious, but it may have just as much meaning for the future of the motor car. If the motor car were suddenly rendered obsolescent, so far as urban life were concerned, the pressure upon our metropolitan areas would end. Much of the urban complex would fall away, and the city would be redesigned as a human neighborhood. The purpose of the city is to accelerate human transactions in as many different areas as possible. Reading that again. The purpose of the city is to accelerate human transactions in as many different areas as possible. With electric circuitry, such acceleration occurs totally. It happens to all of this part, but with electric circuitry, you're already there. You're already sent. So acceleration occurs instantly with electric circuitry. Circuitry creates an environment of information rather than of hardware. This may indicate that the future of the city is to be a kind of show window or perpetual world's fair for the display of new technology. With new types of transportation and information movement, the city naturally tends to disappear as a place of residence or of work. So everybody was forced to live in cities, you know, 100 years ago for the previous 100 years. As the centralizing effect of the railroad made these big cities, the car decentralized. It begins to decentralize the city and creates urban or suburban sprawl. So with new types of transportation and information circuitry, the city naturally tends to disappear as a place of residence or of work. You ever notice downtown L.A., Leon, quite abandoned once the workday is over, quite empty?
Yes, it becomes a ghost town.
Yes, so who might you see walking around in the evening downtown? You'll see the Bohos, you'll see Jermaine.
Yeah.
You'll see the people who regard the downtown emptiness as a new frontier to explore their identities and enhance the porn industry. In many ways, you don't have to be screwing to be in the porn industry. You could be just making the running the cameras, making
or the lighting
websites.
Well,
the lighting, many
or
jobs,
just being a good promoter.
Beg your pardon?
A promoter.
Be a promoter, yes. I see you're there, Jonathan. No, it's Jim. Actually, it's Jim. Thought it was Jonathan. Let's unmute Jim. So, Jim, you're welcome to speak in a minute or so. I just want to get some more information laid out. Okay, Jim?
No problem. Great.
Jim is a very young person of 73 years old, and he's come to the right place where he's free to be old and young and neither. Basically, eternal. So, we just described the future of the city. So, what's next? Well, let's look at some of the parts of the city called architecture. So, McLuhan says in a little section called The Future of Architecture, just as the electric light and power made the skyscraper possible, so their extension, in other words, the electric light and power, their extension into further dimensions of environment making would seem to point to the enclosure of entire urban areas. So we started talking about these big domes, like the Astrojet Stadium in Houston. Does that sound familiar to you, Leon? The Astrojet Stadium, is that the name of the football place in Houston?
When you say stadium, it gives me an idea exactly what architecture you're talking about, but I am not so familiar with that. But I imagine if the Dallas Cowboys play there, and that's like a huge, you know, stadium because the cheerleaders, but if you want to explain more, go ahead.
Is it a domed? Is Dallas in a dome stadium?
Is Dallas in a dome stadium?
Yeah, the stadium in Dallas, is it a domed stadium?
I'm not too sure. I haven't seen it. I didn't see their particular stadium.
Okay. Well, they have a dome in Toronto. I think that was built in the 80s. Late 70s, early 80s. So anyways, McLuhan's saying, in the late 70s, he's writing this, the Astrojet Stadium in Houston is such an environment where you've enclosed the entire urban area. That is, it's air-conditioned the year-round. Now, the Astrojet Stadium doesn't enclose all of Houston, but it's the beginning of enclosing an environment. McLuhan says, a city so enclosed could program its climate and weather entirely. The character of building in such an enclosed environment would tend to change drastically. In other words, once you had the dome over the city, what you added on the world of skyscrapers and buildings and whatever would be changed. Building would be for the sake of privacy as much as for anything else. As soon as the urban areas were enclosed by plastic or other means, the building program would become oriented toward individual needs as much as clothing is now oriented towards individual needs. So he's basically seen the future of the architecture in the domed kind of environments, and that would change the role of privacy. So that's just a short part. So then, now you're walking around the city and you're looking at the architecture. So what would be the next thing? Well, you probably say, well, what will I do with myself? It's a wonderful life I have here in this dome city. What are my objectives? So there's a section here called The Future of Objectives. So McLuhan says the same thing happens to objectives as to products in the electric age. Now, he said products become obsolete in the electric age. Objectives, therefore, become obsolete. These objectives are extended into environmental form. For example, a man who is deeply involved in any operation or in a condition has no point of view. So, for example, a male or female who is deeply involved in the electronic circuitry world in an operation or in a condition has no point of view. If you're deeply involved, the less point of view you have. So, for example, a man who's deeply involved in any operation or in any condition has no point of view. A point of view is itself the result of very special structure in technology and in experience. It is only possible in an environment that allows priority to visual organization. So a point of view comes into a world of sight and the extension of sight, which we know as the Gutenberg galaxy. Natives and children do not have a point of view because they are inclined to use all their senses at once in relation to their world. They're not just using their eyes. One might speak about a point of view, quote, from where I am sitting, but not from where I am swimming. You have no point of view when you're swimming. Points of view and objectives occur in visual structures or in visually structured situations because these submit to fragmentation. Both point of view and objectives, therefore, since they tend to be highly fragmented and specialist and static, also tend to be related to time. Here's Ion coming in saying there's no time. So time was a product of the Gutenberg phase. An objective or a point of view tends to relate to a particular moment or period of time. Now, the alternative, McLuhan writes, is the systems or total field approach, or systems approach, that tends to come in quite naturally with electric circuitry. Electric circuitry is another term for electric environment. When all information is simultaneously available, the nature of objectives is greatly altered. The speed-up factor in information movement is decisive in the creation of new environments for human transactions. So he's really stressing the speed-up to the point of simultaneous interaction. That's the characteristics of the main characteristic of the new electric age. Since it is of the very essence of new environments to be imperceptible, it is almost inevitable that the programming of human enterprises will be carried out with an eye on the preceding environment. So people will go about with forming objectives based on the rearview mirror, what they can see, what they think is an art form. So many, many people, including women, went into the job force in the 60s and 70s because it was obsolete. Obsolete means there's more and more of it, but it was not forming the actual present. The present was being formed by instantaneous, simultaneous speed-up and electric circuitry, which was making everything in the past an art form or something you could grab onto for your identity. So, doing this again, since it is of the very essence of new environments to be imperceptible, it is almost inevitable that the programming of human enterprises will be carried out with an eye on the preceding environment. It is characteristic of the operation of new environments created by new technologies to make the old environment strongly present to the attention. In the age of the railway, it was the farming community that became especially visible. In the age of the electronic computer environment, it is the old mechanical environment that becomes most perceptible. McLuhan wrote a lot about a lot of the art forms, cubism, surrealism, dada, fauvism, many of the art forms of the first half of the 20th century was turning the old mechanical environment into an art form. When Warhol came along with pop art and put the Campbell's soup can in the museum, he was making people aware of the old hardware consumer packages and products, the Brillo soap box, the Campbell's soup can. These were old hardware products which were obsolesced by the new invisible processing and knowing of the electronic work in the electric circuitry world. So in the age of the electronic computer environment, no longer is the farming community of special attention, but it is the old industrial environment that becomes most perceptible. In the age of the space capsule that creates a new environment for the Earth, it is the old terrestrial environment, or the old Earth, that becomes especially present to our awareness, and hence the birth of Earth Day in April 22, 1970. And has pollution stopped? Have they improved... Have they made the world safer for ecology? That's still up in the air, if there's any progress been made. Did giving up smoking, is that a good sign? Is that ecology? Okay, it is the psychic mechanisms of this sort. So now he's talking about the general procedure of the McLuhan unconscious. The new environment creates the old environment as figure. It is the psychic mechanisms of this sort. So it's an automatic process, what we're describing here, that ensures that nearly all business enterprises are conducted in terms of yesterday's breadwinners. the 10% of the events in the business that cause 90% of the events in the invisible environmental area. So he's saying that the real action in a business is in the 10% of the business, the part that's not visible. And everybody's engaged in the 90% of the events that are visible. Yet it is the 10% area that is the area of opportunity and new potential. So I'll read that paragraph again. So we're talking about a psychic collective mechanism. It is the psychic mechanism of this sort that ensures that nearly all business enterprises are conducted in terms of yesterday's breadwinners. The 10% of the events in the business that cause 90% of the events is the invisible environmental area. Yet it is this 10% area that is the area of opportunity and new potential. If objectives as means of organizing enterprises must be considered in the electric age, the same is true of private lives and careers. In the electric age, young people find it very difficult to be goal-oriented. And that's true of your generation, Leon, and the generation before you, Generation X, and the baby boomers. I guess now you got the 15-year-olds who refuse to come out of their bedroom. They're so averse to having a goal, they won't even bother getting out of bed. And that's just the chemical body. So McLuhan predicted this. If objectives, he says, as means of organizing enterprise must be considered in the electric age, the same is true of private lives and careers. They must be shown to be completely frustrated by the instant world. In the electric age, young people find it very difficult to be goal-oriented. So we've done the future of the planet, what someone is born into. Then we did the future of education. You go to school. You're forced to go to school, or you go to homeschooling. But they want to program you with book values. Then you get a job or try to find a role, the future of work. And then in the evenings when you finish your work, you wander around in the city. We found out what the city is. The city actually is not the hardware. It is the electric circuitry that gives you the task of knowing as doing. And then you walk around, look at the particular aspects of the city. So we had the future of architecture. And then after you look at the city, what are you going to do next? What are your objectives? You got an hour or two before you got to go home and go to sleep and get up for work next day. So what would be your objective? Go to a club or a bar? Go home and watch TV and process knowing? Okay, so that leads to another category. Since May, in the 50s and 60s, the book was still a very dominant rearview mirror, we better look into the future of the book. So McLuhan wrote, "The future of the book and management. With electric circuitry, all the mechanical enterprises of mankind tend to acquire reverse characteristics." So that means books and the book culture is going to require reverse characteristics. "Just as the educational establishment tends to shift its stress from instruction to discovery, with the audience directly involved in the learning processes, so all mechanical industry tends to abandon packaging in favor of the tailor-made or custom-built service for the individual. This pattern begins to emerge in computer design procedures in architecture. It appears quite spectacularly in the world of the book and of publishing with the advent of xerography. The book was the first mass-produced object. It was the first repeatable and uniform product. The process by which this kind of product was achieved was a process that was soon extended to many other forms of making." So he's talking about what happened when the book became the constitutive, the forming, the hidden ground of society 300 years ago. "This process by which this kind of book product was achieved was a process that was soon extended to many other forms of making." That means the mass production and the fragmentation of living processes is what's going to happen with the book. "The process consists in the extreme fragmentation, the actual writing, the printing press, is the extreme fragmentation of the ancient craft of the scribe. Printing from movable types is not only an analytic procedure of extreme fragmentation, but it fathers similar fragmentation in many areas of human perception and human action, including the fragmented action of getting a job and having a job on the assembly line." So McLuhan says, "It is precisely this process of analytic fragmentation on which were built all the fabrics of modern production and marketing and pricing, let's say up to World War II. It is a process that dissolves with the advent of electric circuitry. So it started to dissolve everything with the telegraph 150 years ago, and that led to several identity crises, or World War I and World War II and civil wars all over the planet, because the electric circuitry was contradicting the Gutenberg archetype of modern production, marketing, and pricing. The dissolution of the Gutenberg process can be illustrated from the effects of xerography on book publication. Xerography makes the reader both author and publisher in tendency. The highly centralized activity of publishing naturally breaks down into extreme decentralism when anybody can, by means of xerography, assemble printed or written or photographic materials which can be supplied with soundtracks. So that would be 50, 60 years ago. Then he has one more paragraph here on the future of the book. There are many electric information services at present that permit individuals to phone. Now, here he's predicting the Internet, talking about the Internet. Now, this is he first made this prediction in mid-60s, but now it's 14 years later. So he's updating or speaking about this Internet vision, and it's more believable by people by the end of the 70s when people start getting their personal computers. There are many electric information services at present that permit individuals to phone for printed data on any subject whatever. Computers are ready to go to work on their specific problem or interest on the personal phones, on their particular problem or interest. Bibliographies and printed materials from many parts of the world can be made available to the individual in a few hours. The whole tendency of xerography is to transform the book into a tailor-made, custom-built service. The book is ceasing to be a mass-produced package or commodity in a fashion that provides a very good index to the changing aspect of the world itself as it becomes a responsive information environment. That's the living Android meme. But I'll reread that. He's saying that the way the book changes is an index to the change that the electric circuitry is bringing in and the Android meme is bringing in. So reading that sentence again, the book is ceasing to be a mass-produced package or commodity in a fashion that provides, so in a way, means in a way. The book is ceasing to be a mass-produced package or commodity in a way that provides a very good index. So this change in the book provides a very good index to the changing aspect of the world itself as the world itself becomes a responsive information environment. As the specific individual needs become paramount in the new bookmaking, the public is drawn into the bookmaking process. One of the main points McLuhan says about the electric age is the audience gets in the act. Now, he makes a little comment on William Burroughs' cut-up method. He says, Burroughs' cut-up process flips book as outer expression into inner trip from left hemisphere to right hemisphere. So Burroughs replays the movement to right hemisphere book consumption laid out by the radical modernist known as the Vorticist, especially James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. So William Burroughs' cut-up process flips book as outer expression into inner trip from left hemisphere to right hemisphere. He just penciled that in. So that was the future of the book. Here's a good one. So what is conscious and what is unconscious? So here's the future of the unconscious. One of the bizarre features of the human, now this is going to be complex. I did a recording with Roxana on the genres of the unconscious, which will show up in her next video, which is part of a trilogy. The first one, something at Pergamos, the Thunders at Pergamos Wake. That's number one. There's a second one coming, and then there will be the unconscious. I don't know if the unconscious will be in the second video or the third video of his trilogy. And these are long videos. The first one, The Thunders at Pergamos' Wake, is about an hour long. So, in the future of the unconscious, one of the bizarre features of the human interest in the unconscious during the past century, so that's from 1870 to 1970, has been the steady erosion of the unconscious. So, one of the bizarre features of the human interest in the unconscious during the past century has been the steady erosion of the unconscious. Just as our forefathers stripped forests and topsoils, recent generations have been engaged on the frontiers of consciousness, stripping away the ancient growths of the collective unconscious. McLuhan, by the mid-60s, was announcing the presence globally of the collective conscious, not the unconscious. Many of the unconscious territories and properties have been taken over as ordinary features of consciousness. An electric responsive environment, in other words, the Android meme, really extends consciousness physically and technologically. The environment has for countless centuries been the world of the extended unconscious. That's McLuhan's technological unconscious, where every new technology created new dynamics that the humans live too slowly to notice. It's in the 20th century when these turnovers of technology happen rapidly that we begin to notice McLuhan's technological unconscious. So the environment has for countless centuries been the world of the extended unconscious. The new environment is that of which we are always unaware. It is the latest extension of man's unconscious processes. So the latest technological environment is the latest unconscious. To become aware of the unconscious is likewise to become aware of the new environment. This awareness in turn accelerates the erosion of the unconscious itself. So McLuhan became popular in the mid-60s because he was presenting a way of becoming conscious of the habitual creation of the unconscious by the technological unconscious. In an environment that was collectively conscious, and the collective unconscious was the actual present in the 60s, so everybody started exploring the unconscious as an art form. That would be Esalen, the human potential movement, the cults, the sensory explorations, the things that Jim was involved in. These were all rearview mirror processes, Jim, who's listening here, led to many kinds of teachers and gurus. They were studying what was no longer there in the actual present. They were studying the past, the unconscious. Now, McLuhan was the best guy to understand this process. So if you were stuck with the fellow citizens engaged in exploring their unconscious and calling it the expansion of their consciousness, you had the edge on everybody by knowing that they were expressing an unawareness of the technological unconscious. So if the unconscious performs a needful function for conscious life, in other words, it's a necessary complementary process, that consciousness cannot engage in the whole environment, be aware of it, so you naturally create a temporary unconscious based on the ratios of the new technology. Now, you'll see that on my tiny note chart, the ratios of each phase, the LaRouche phase, the McLuhan phase, the Thompson phase, and the Kroger phase, and the Dobbs phase, has a ratio which is a temporary unconscious. So if the unconscious performs a needful function for conscious life, if it is a means of processing private and individual awareness, then it behooves us to understand this function before the unconscious has been obliterated. An ecological approach to the interplay of the forces with consciousness and the unconscious is indicated. So McLuhan says we must start creating an unconscious ecologically as we, in the digital era, experience no unconsciousness. This may be hard for humans to handle. So much of wealth-making over the last 25, 30 years has been creating stupidity. I used to say wealth is made from stupidity, and stupidity would be the unconscious. We need more and more stupidity. I used to say in my radio show in Toronto, we are here not to expand your consciousness. We are here to drive you to sleep. And here's McLuhan, in a way that nobody understood back then, saying that for psychic balance, we will have to make a temporary unconscious. So when everybody gets in Web 2.0 gets their own Facebook page and then insults everybody else by acting so stupid and describing their daily nothings and trivia in their life, they're engaging in a temporary virtual unconscious to create wealth and sanity. Now, isn't that amazing? You never heard that said ever before, Jim. This is profound new knowledge about the process of making the unconscious. And we still haven't heard from Kate and Jermaine. Let's check my emails. Maybe they're saying, oh, here's Kate, what she's saying. So she wrote in, well, right before the show, I'm going to call in from landline, blocked ID. I have to work and make dinner, so I'll speak at the beginning, but then have to mute myself for the first 20 minutes. Well, if you're there, where are you, Kate? I don't see where, I don't have anything muted. So I don't know what you mean by that. So Kate's trying to contribute, but she's created a temporary unconscious incommunicability. Okay, so what were we doing? Okay, let's check the other emails, the other source, to see if Jermaine typed there. Okay, write that in. write this in. I'm creating a temporary unconscious here by engaging in a direction, an objective of going and looking at the emails. Nope. No emails from Jermaine. Okay, so back to this really important section, the future of the unconscious. I'm going to reread it now that you got a clue where it's going. One of the bizarre features of the human interest in the unconscious, see, people are obsessed with the unconscious, even though it's been stripped off in many forms. The Freudian unconscious was made conscious. The collective unconscious of Jung was made conscious. The Foucauldian early Neo-McLuhan unconscious was stripped off. And the only person who could handle the present collective consciousness was McLuhan. And maybe Cosmic Awareness, the Evergreens, and, of course, Ion. One of the bizarre features of the human interest in the unconscious during the past century has been the steady erosion of the unconscious. So remember, he's saying that we are going...